Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. One of science's greatest mysteries is how life on Earth started. And we are joined via Skype today by one of those collaborators, MIT scientist Dr. Rogier Brockman. And he's going to talk to us about the origin of life. Rogier Brockman, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve. It's very nice to be here.
I'd like to spend most of our show on the two prominent models for the origin of life, the so-called primordial soup model and the metabolism first model.
Mm-hmm.
But let's start with learning more about your background and that of your fellow collaborators, because one of the things that really struck me in preparing for this show was how interdisciplinary all the work is on the origin of life.
Okay, happy to. So my background, I started off in chemistry during my undergraduate studies, sort of a passion for evolution at the same time drove me to want to take a more historical look, in a way, on chemistry. And so I started taking some classes in astronomy, and that drove me into a field called astrochemistry, which tries to understand how organic molecules are formed outside of Earth's atmosphere in the interstellar medium. And that's what I did for my PhD. After my PhD, I realized that I wanted to understand living systems, or life, I guess, a little bit better, because the gap between molecules in space and, big organisms here on Earth is, of course, a very large gap. And so that's when I came to the Santa Fe Institute and where I started to study the origin of life directly and the early evolution of life, focusing on metabolic chemistry, where metabolism is the chemical system that works inside cells to constantly create and recreate the building blocks of cells, in a sense, generating life. So that's what I did in Santa Fe for some years, and now I'm working here at MIT and sort of thinking on those kind of questions in a slightly more ecological setting. So how do those sort of metabolic processes work in the ocean? We studied during
What would that have to do with the origin of life?
The thing about life, of course, is that, we don't really know necessarily where to, begin asking the question, just because it's a very large question. And so you end up coming at it from many different kinds of directions. And so, people that, for example, work in this area would be, chemists, but also geologists, planetary scientists. Long-term other collaborators is a biophysicist.
Biophysicist. And what does that mean?
Yeah, so again, another broad term, I guess. So biophysics is, people that study the physical processes of life. So either using physics approaches to study cells, or specifically just studying the physical properties of cells.
So the Santa Fe Institute is sort of known for complexity science, and I suppose this would be a great example of what that is, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's actually the biggest reason that I was drawn to the Santa Fe Institute was not even the origin of life itself. That ended up being what the sort of the topic that I ended up wanting to study there. But what fascinated me about that place is that it's like a playground for science in my mind. I read a book about its formation when I was an undergraduate, and I was just fascinated by this place where people would come together from all backgrounds in science, literally. So economics, archaeology, biology, math, chemistry, what have you, and just try to think about the most general principles and biggest questions we can sort of come up with together. And by talking to people from such very different backgrounds, sort of learn to step outside of the box from your own training and to take a different look at things. And so that was always very fascinating to me. And so that's what drew me there. And, and then when I was going there, I ended up meeting Eric and had become interested more specifically in the origin of life. And so we started to work together.
Well, what I'd like to do is move on to the two dominant theories, the primordial soup model and metabolism first model. But first, I'd like maybe an explanation of what is life. What do we consider life, or what do you consider life? And so, what is it exactly we're talking about?
It's a great question. I don't think that there is one sort of consensus definition out there of what life exactly is.
Uh-huh.
It depends a little bit on the background of people and how they come at the question as to what answer they probably would give you. So some people might say, for example, that it has to be a cell. Some other people might say that it has to sort of be able to self-replicate, so a cell being able to double to another cell. You know, other people might say that it has to be an organized form of chemistry, right, that is able to transmit sort of organized flows of energy. It depends a little bit on who you would ask. But the thing is, I think about it, is that it's okay if we don't know the exact definition, because in a way, what you want to do with science is you want to have sort of try to understand particular aspects of it. And, you know, there are definitely certain features of life that most people would agree on are part of the definition, even if we don't have a full definition. And then we can try to understand how those features or those aspects of life came into existence.
All right. So if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and via Skype, I have one of the authors of an exhibit that's at the New Mexico Museum of History and Science, and his name is Dr. Rogier Brockman, and we're talking about the origin of life, and I'd like to start, if we could, Rogier, with the primordial soup sort of model. And yeah. I read somewhere that it was actually Darwin that first theorized this. I don't know if that's true.
I think that life may have started in some warm little pond.
Right.
And, you know, those ideas were then further developed, I think.
So that's 1860, so that's a long time ago.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I'm not a historian of science, so, you know, I might be misrepresenting or skipping over some parts, but I think those ideas sort of came together more in the early 20th century from a couple of different authors. And basically the idea of the primordial soup is that, you know, a bunch of sort of complex organic molecules were formed either in the interstellar medium through the process of, you know, during the process and preceding star formation and then deposited by comets on our planet. Through electrical discharges in the early atmosphere that produced, certain compounds, you know, or other processes on Earth and itself, and sort of together, you know, created this diverse mixture of organic molecules. And then, you know, as the Earth did its own dynamical processes, you know, with the sun coming in on there and temperatures fluctuating and so on, that eventually that would have led to the emergence of sort of more complex life. And I think the direction that theory ended up going, I should be careful in, again, not being sort of someone who has studied the history of necessarily those ideas. But the way the primordial soup idea is sometimes also thought of, I guess, in my mind, I would actually separate the two main models, not per se in the framing of primordial soup versus metabolism first.
Okay.
But rather more versus genetic information first and replication first versus metabolism.
Okay.
And the difference between those two is that in the sort of gene first or replication first, there the idea is that you... what is one of the critical things that defines life is to be able to harness information and to maintain that information and to transmit it to the next generations, right? And so the idea of replicating a cell and in a genome is sort of a central defining feature of life in that thinking. And so because at some point we learned it, actually not that long ago, even in the, I think it was in the 60s and 70s, that RNA molecules, which is sort of a cousin of DNA molecules, can catalyze reactions themselves. This sort of led to the idea that, you know, these sort of polymers that now are used to store information in cells originally did both things, in which they stored the information but also drove drove the chemistry, and then that sort of led to life. And so the inputs in going back a little bit to your primordial soup analogy, then the inputs that gave rise to those polymers, are now maybe no longer produced through the same chemical processes today, right? So the idea for the in the sort of primordial super in this case, then genes or replication first idea is that some chemical processes produced, you know, eventually polymers of information storing molecules, and those then sort of modified the chemistry that produced themselves, and that's sort of how life took off.
So why would that happen? First of all, when would this be happening, and secondly, why would that happen?
So, again, that's not really my area, so I have not really worked on specifically on that side of it. But I guess that would have happened very early on in the Earth.
When I was reading 3.8 billion years ago.
Yeah. So
with the Earth being about 4.5 billion years.
Yeah. So estimates right now on how old life is are again, not fully settled, partly because it's just hard to infer, you know, because the first life probably didn't leave or did not leave fossils. So you have to figure out then through sort of indirect means in a way when life started. And so I think that the first concrete fossils are now thought to be, I think, around 3.8 billion years or so, you know, which suggests that life may have started a little bit before that even.
I see.
So probably not that long, maybe even after the formation of our Earth. But that's the one sort of way of thinking. And then the other thinking, which is sort of metabolism first ideas or...
Well, before we get to metabolism first, I want to raise this experiment, which I found so fascinating, the Miller-Urey experiment,
right.
Which I think occurs in the early 50s. Uh-huh. And this was maybe it would be much better if you explained what the experiment was rather than me.
Yeah, so this experiment was done, like you said, at the University of Chicago in the 1950s. And basically what they did is they took a flask or a set of connected flasks, I think is how it worked. And then they bubbled, you know, water and various gases together through this thing, creating basically a vapor system and in a way that they thought was sort of a model of the early Earth's atmosphere. And then what they did is they discharged electricity through those gases to see what it would have created. And what they found is that it created a bunch of amino acids. And so then that was, you know, which are one of the building blocks of life and of cells. And so when they found that was, of course, very exciting. And I think that captured a lot of people's imagination and, you know, and so, yeah, so that was kind of a big breakthrough in some sense. I think we have since accepted that the conditions that they used in those particular flasks were probably not exactly representative of what the early Earth atmosphere was like. So the quest in a way has since then has been to figure out, to try to understand better what those conditions would have been and, you know, whether such processes or other ones contributed to making the first sort of complex chemistries.
But nonetheless, this was the first creation in the lab of an amino acid, which is a building block of life, right? That leads it. Well, when it supposedly leads to the creation of life, but how does it do that? I don't think I quite understand.
That's a very good question. I don't have a good answer for you either, because I guess the way the thinking would have gone is, you know, that then subsequent other processing of that materials, either in the environment or in some other way, led to those amino acids and other molecules produced through similar or other processes to accumulate and to start polymerizing and assembling into more complex structures.
Yeah, so we don't get to the point that you were identifying earlier, this sort of RNA world.
Yeah, so that's a bit
through amino acids directly.
First of all, there is a general distinction, which is that RNA and DNA are not made from amino acids. They are made from what are called nucleotides, mm-hmm. which is a different set of molecules. Amino acids are the inputs that from which proteins are made, and so proteins is what, you know, actually perform a lot of the functions in cells today, and are what a lot of tissues are also built from in our cells and so on. And So they're sort of slightly different categories of molecules today, not just today, just in general. Exactly. So finding amino acids doesn't actually like necessarily then get us to RNA. That's a separate process. And so that has been one of the big quests in for experimental chemists working in that area and sort of taking that view on things, is to try to find the conditions in the lab through which you could produce those nucleotides that became RNA.
And that hasn't happened yet, it sounds like.
There's a lot of sort of exciting processes, progress has been made. I don't know that we sort of currently have, you know, chemistry that necessarily everyone agrees on was the kind of chemistry on early Earth that did produce those molecules. But people have been working to try to create those nucleotides. And I think they have made progress in sort of producing some nucleotides from chemistries that look more and more like, or are thought to look more and more like the kinds of chemistry that you would have had on the early Earth.
Interesting. Okay, so this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're very pleased to have via Skype Dr. Rogier Brockman. And Dr. Brockman is the author of an exhibit that he worked with other collaborators on from the Santa Fe Institute that's at the New Mexico Museum of History. Just Google New Mexico Museum of History, look under exhibits, and look under emergence. So let's talk now about metabolism first, which my sense is this is the sort of model that you favor. And maybe you could start by telling us what metabolism first is and why you favor it as a model.
Yeah, that sounds really good to me. Actually, but before we do that, I just want to make a brief comment, because you mentioned the exhibit a couple of times.
Yes.
And I just wanted to mention that my role and the scientist's role was in fact much more of sort of consulting and helping explain some of the scientific principles. The real work went into it was done by an amazing group of students, in fact, from New Mexico?
I think it's New Mexico Tech. I'm not sure.
No, I think it's Highlands.
Okay.
I'm forgetting. But it was an amazing group of students in the media arts department I think it's New Mexico Highlands University. I'm unfortunately blanking on the name. And people from the state itself. And so, they had this idea and were developing these amazing exhibits that, you know, you can go see. And so, you know, our job was to try to, you know, help explain a little bit some of the underlying ideas.
Okay.
It was an amazing experience. The students involved were incredibly creative and put together really beautiful exhibits. And it was actually really inspiring to work with them.
All right. So metabolism first.
Yes. Metabolism first. Small detour. So you have that idea on the one hand, which is you have a bunch of to recapitulate briefly the replication idea, is that you have some chemical process producing some complex chemistry, and then once it turns into these self-replicating polymers, they change that chemistry. Whereas in the metabolism first framework or way of thinking, there the focus is on trying to explain how you get to organized forms of chemistry in the first place. So, you know, whichever molecules you are producing to become cells later on, or to become the building blocks of cells, you have to have some organized form already present in the abiotic world that are producing them, you know, not just producing one molecule of a particular kind, but producing a steady supply of some kind.
Abiotic means non-living?
Yes, exactly. That means preceding life itself.
Okay.
And so then the idea of the sort of metabolism first thinking is that life today as we know it and metabolism as we know it today is essentially a continuation of those prebiotic processes. So not so much replacing the original chemistry that produced those molecules, but rather fortifying them and continuing them in a sort of more biologically specific and optimized way. So, for example, some geochemical process, so that's a chemical process in the geological world, early on going on, you know, some pathway, some sequence of reactions you know, that maybe some close variant of that sequence of reactions may still be preserved in cells today, very similar to what was going on the early Earth, except that the molecules that were performing the reaction were, you know, maybe not, were on the early Earth, maybe minerals, let's say, right, that were acting as sort of the catalyst or the helpers.
So how does a mineral do that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It depends on the properties of the mineral, but what can happen is that, you know, molecules can sort of stick to a mineral surface, for example, and that can bring those molecules in close contact to each other and enhance the rate at which those molecules then form another molecule. And so different types of minerals can do different types of reactions. And so then in the metabolism first type thinking, basically those reactions that were happening on those minerals are still happening today. It's just no longer minerals, but it's now proteins and enzymes that are doing essentially those same reactions. So that, I think, is part of the difference in the between the two models.
In all these models, you sort of need a spark of some kind, right, to start
right.
the process, or do you? I guess maybe we don't know.
Yes.
The ideas. Yeah, go ahead.
Again, that's an excellent question. I think one of the, you know, another important property of life today, and this is especially true once you go to sort of what we call larger levels of organization. So when you go from a single cell to a whole organism, or from a whole organism to a whole ecosystem, is that the order that exists within those systems is derived or is maintained by the flow of energy. And so you're exactly right that to get the process started, at some point along there has to be a coupling that emerges between some energy flows in the environment and those that we see in life and in cells today. And so the arising of that coupling is indeed is an important part of understanding the whole thing.
So one of the things I read in preparing for the show was that this sort of beginning energy source could be something like I read about something called thermophiles, which are a kind
yeah.
of extremophile that live at the very bottom of the ocean in these very hot vents that are coming, you know, where volcanic molten material is coming up. And it could possibly, and those things continue to exist right today, and they're
yes.
they don't use oxygen, right? It's a full chemical process. So somehow these are living cells, bacteria, mm-hmm. is that right?
Yes,
they somehow convert into energy. Inorganic material, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So the discovery of these systems was a really big deal, and happened in the late 70s when, with basically with submarines, they went to these deep sea underwater volcanoes, and quite to their surprise, they found these spectacularly energetic and active and diverse ecosystems of microbes, but not just microbes, also of crabs and of tube worms that contained microbes, bacteria and archaea, living there. And so this was, and as you say, they were kind of self-contained and away from the sun, because before that, the perspective on life is that it's all derived from sunlight. And suddenly here at the bottom of the ocean, you find this life that's living not of sunlight, but off of energy coming out of these underwater volcanoes. And not only that, but then when they started to do what's called phylogenetic analysis, so that's just looking at the sequences of letters in the DNA and sort of building family trees to understand where on the tree of life these organisms living in those locations fall on that tree, they realized that a lot of the bacteria and also archaea that you find in those environments form sort of the deepest branches on the tree of life, indicating that they were very ancestral types of life and very old preserved forms of biochemistry. And so that has indeed, organized the community. Not everyone agrees, again, it depends a little bit on the perspective, of course, but this has had a huge impact on the origin of life field. And, you know, definitely, I would say a large part of the community now does believe that such sites are a likely situation in which life could have originally arisen.
So this would be the common ancestor of humans, these thermophiles?
Yeah, it's crazy to think that. But in a way, yeah. I mean, the thing actually to realize is that us humans are just a minute, you know, if you look at the larger tree of life, we are just a minuscule part of it, right? So you have this huge tree which has three main branches called the bacteria, the archaea, and the eukaryotes. And we are essentially one type of eukaryotes, which forms one cluster of small branches on top of this large branch of eukaryotes. And so, but if you trace that whole branch of the eukaryotes and of the bacteria and of the archaea all back towards the root, then you would end up finding a lot of the types of organisms that you find at those underwater volcanoes.
All right, so that's truly amazing. But we're nearing the end of the show, and so I want to sort of ask you a more general question about the origin of life, because as you've explained, there's still a fair number of gaps in our explanation for the origin of life, how it evolved.
The way that I think about it is that if, you know, people coming together from all of our different backgrounds, be it, you know, how planets and stars are formed, chemists studying these processes in the lab, or biologists trying to trace back life to its roots, what all of this does is it sort of narrows the place for us to look for questions and answers. And so even if we may not find the specific answer of all of the specific details, that space for answers and questions will keep shrinking. And I think from that, we can come up with probably, I do believe that, you know, just science will lead us to getting a much clearer picture of the general principles that gave rise to life on Earth.
Well, we're going to have to end the conversation there. I would like to thank my guest today, Dr. Ruhir Brockman. Dr. Brockman is an MIT scientist. Thanks also to my producer, Jefferson White. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available at iTunes. Archives of my past shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.